It justifies to the people of Israel and Judah that they had truly chosen this for themselves. God had not maliciously chosen to destroy them. They had chosen to turn away from him. And so he talks about how they have been spiritual adulterers. They had been unfaithful in their relationship with God. He talks about how they had the opportunity to return to him, but they had refused to return. He gives a sermon in the temple and points out all the religious things they were doing. They were in the temple. They were giving sacrifices. They were praying. But that doesn't undo all the other decisions that they were making in their life. You don't change the wickedness of your heart by adding religion on top of it. He says that the things that are happening to them now, that are coming out, the things that are happening in their near future, are all laid out in the covenant long time ago. They had all agreed to the terms. We would obey in this way, and then we would be blessed in this way. But if we disobey in this way, we would be cursed in this way. And he says, everything that's coming, we've already agreed to. I've agreed to, you've agreed to. Because you've broken the covenant, this is where we are. He gives an illustration of a linen girdle and how they had gone from him to the world and had been corrupted by the world. And so, as a visual illustration to show what they had become, how what they had changed into. Now, at the very end of this section, he gives a discussion with Jeremiah. I originally called it the Sermon of the Drought, but I changed it to the Argument over the Drought, because this whole passage in chapter 14 and 15 is a discussion between Jeremiah and God. And Jeremiah, he's a righteous man, but in this argument, and I gave you the whole thing, each time God talks, Jeremiah talks. God talks, Jeremiah talks. There's a drought in the land. It's not raining. He describes how bad it is. Children are being sent to the well and going and having no water and going home with their head covered, ashamed that they have an empty bucket. Plowmen are going out to the field and checking on their crops to see if they've grown, and nothing is growing. And Jeremiah takes issue with God. He asks God to be faithful to his people anyway, and God says, no, but the people have been unfaithful to me. Jeremiah states that, well, I mean, everybody thinks it'll be fine. They've been told it'll be fine. The prophets have told them that everything will turn out okay. And God says, but that isn't true. And so here we continue this morning. We continue on with this argument as we finish up this major section of the book, which is chapters 2 through 15. We'll be in chapter 15 this morning. Jeremiah is almost arguing with God about what's happening in his country, because he's upset with what's happening in his country. He's discouraged about his people and his country. And it's not that he's not laying the blame for what's happening on God's shoulders, because he continues to acknowledge, we have sinned. But he says, but God, can't you just not make it turn out so bad anyway? Can't you just continue to have mercy again? Can't you just forgive anyway? And so God, and he almost holds God responsible to be more merciful and more gracious. They're going through a drought, and Jeremiah complains, and God's going to tell him that this nation is marching steadily and surely toward utter destruction. God would not destroy them forever in this passage, nor would he ever destroy them forever. But right now, for the sake of the nation's future, he would take drastic measures for them in the present. Jeremiah is a righteous man. And so the question that we see in this last chapter is one that I want to ask us this morning. How do you live as a righteous man in a world that is doomed to be destroyed because of its sin? He's in a really interesting spot, because he can't distance himself from it. He lives in the country. So everything that's happening to his country effectively happens to him, too. And so he grapples back and forth with, save the nation around me, to also, it shouldn't be so bad for me either. I'm trying to do what's right, and I have to live here, and I have to go to the temple, and I have to go to the market, and if everything around me is destroyed, it also gets destroyed for me too. And so he continues to grapple with God. Now, I'm going to give us this morning very quickly, as we walk through this passage, because it's best if we just walk through it, 5 truths that this passage teaches us about living as a righteous person in a doomed world. But I want to give you 2 quick cautions before we begin. They're not in your notes. Two cautions before we begin. This passage specifically, chapter 15, which is where we are this morning, This passage does not emphasize reaching those the people around you. This one specifically. This is a discussion between Jeremiah and God and about himself. And so the fact that that's true doesn't mean that that's not important, okay? The best way to fix the problem is to bring the people around you to the Lord, not to just complain about the issues that are around you. And so we have, as Christians, we would have a great commission. Jeremiah, as a prophet, had the commission to go and preach truth and to tell people to return to the Lord. So just because that's not in this chapter and it's not one of my points doesn't mean it's not an important point, okay? We good with that? The second thing that I want us to caution ourselves on is the title of my message, because of Jeremiah and the world around him. It's very much of a dichotomy. Jeremiah and the people are two ends of the spectrum. And so the title of the message is Living as a Righteous Person in a Doomed World. My second caution is we should be careful to just label ourselves the righteous person, because that's what we want to do. We're the good ones and they're the bad ones. And what we've seen already is that, for example, Jeremiah, every time he says the sin of our nation, he says we have sinned. Because just because Jeremiah is trying to follow the Lord doesn't mean that he's an innocent human completely. And the same thing is true. Just because God might be judging the sin of those out there doesn't mean that there's nothing in our own life that we need to take care of. And so let's be careful not to just label ourselves as the good ones and everyone else as the bad ones. Whether we like it or not, we do have our own sin that must be addressed, and it's possible that we are part of the problem ourselves, because all sin is an abomination to God. So keep those in mind as we walk through these points, and I hope these will be a help to you. Living as a righteous person in a doomed world. Number one, righteous intercession, like interceding on behalf of other people, does not manipulate God's plan. Does not manipulate God's plan. Now, let me be very careful with this, because I'm not saying that prayer makes no difference. I'm not saying that God doesn't take your prayer into account when he makes decisions in eternity, and that he always knows what prayers you would give. However, we also must be careful that on the flip side, we're not under the impression that the moment we don't want something to be what it is, we have the license to just tell God to make it different. Now, I want us to go back very briefly before we start in chapter 15. I want us to turn to chapter 14 and remind ourselves something in this passage that we read last week very briefly, because this is apropos to the very beginning of the chapter here. So look very quickly at verse 11. I gave you all these passages so you can follow along quickly. Verse 11 of chapter 14. He says this, "Then said the Lord unto me, pray not for this people, for their good. When they fast, I will not hear their cry. When they offer burnt offering and an oblation, I will not accept them. But I will consume them by the sword and by the famine and by the pestilence." Now, this passage is not saying to all people at all times in every place, don't pray for the people around you. He's just saying, Jeremiah, I've already decided how this is going. I've already told you how it's going to go. I already told you what is happening next. And Jeremiah, because he loves his people and he loves his nation, is asking God to not do what God just promised he would do next. And he tells Jeremiah, stop, this is what's happening. And so communicate that to the people, but don't ask me to keep on turning it backward. Now, think about Jeremiah though for a second. Put yourself in his shoes. He's a good man. He's one of the only people doing right in the entire nation. He's not the only one. He's not. He'll have some allies we'll meet here later on in the book, like Baruch, who is the scribe, and those types of people. But he probably feels, so we can praise him for that, but he probably almost feels like God doesn't care about what he's saying anymore, right? Because he's preaching, people aren't listening. That's frustrating. Oh, that's frustrating. When I became youth pastor, I was actually under the impression that if I preached something once, then every teenager in my youth group would have that down. And I remember, like, 2 months later, they came to me and said, hey, and they would talk to me about something, and I was legitimately confused. And I was thinking, but you were in youth group when I preached that, so you should be fine. Like, I was, like, looking, like, what's the question? It's frustrating, because that's not how it works, and I found that out really, really, really fast. Just because you give truth doesn't mean everybody applies truth. So Jeremiah probably feels partly like a failure, doesn't he? A little bit. A little. I mean, come on. If when you have 3,000 people in your church building, that's a lot more encouraging than when you have two. You know, and so when he's going and preaching to the whole nation and everyone hates him, that's discouraging. And then also, he's praying and saying, God, have mercy, spare the people, turn back this, we have sinned, but for your sake, spare us anyway. And he's really playing on God's character, trying to get him to have mercy and extend it a little longer. And God basically says, no. So he probably feels like God doesn't listen either. People don't listen, God doesn't listen. And so God throws in something here, very briefly, to almost encourage him. It's an interesting statement he makes at the beginning of chapter 15. We were just in Psalm chapter 22 on Wednesday with the teenagers. And Psalm 22, many of you know, is prophetic about Jesus on the cross. My God, why hast thou forsaken me? They pierced my hands and feet. They parted my garments. But it was originally written by David when he was going through a lot of things. And one of the things David says in the middle of this passage is he says, our fathers trusted in you, and you delivered them, but I am a worm and no man. And the moment David felt in that psalm like God cared about everyone else but didn't care about me, even though we would look back on history and say, if God cared about anybody, he cared about David. In the moment, he didn't feel that way. Well, we would feel the same way about Jeremiah, wouldn't we? Well, if God hears and blesses anyone's ministry, it's Jeremiah. But in the moment, he certainly didn't feel that way. And so what God does at the beginning of chapter 15 is he pulls up a couple people in history who have been great, great leaders. So look at verse number one, chapter 15. Then said the Lord unto me, though Moses and Samuel stood before me, yet my mind could not be toward this people. Cast them out of my sight and let them go forth. Really quickly, go down to verse number 6. Thou hast forsaken me, saith the Lord, talking about the people. Thou art gone backward. Therefore will I stretch out my hand against thee and destroy thee. I am weary with repenting. He's basically saying to these people, how many second chances do I owe you? Which the answer to that is none. He owes us none. But there comes a point we take undue advantage of God's grace, and we use God's grace as an occasion to a flesh, and that's what they had done. And he says, Jeremiah, it's not you, it's the people. Meaning, it's not like you're not praying long enough or hard enough. If Moses were here praying, this is the decision that I have made. This is where we are going next. If Samuel stood before me and said, God, change the plan, he said, this is where I'm going next. He brings up Samuel. I gave you a couple passages very briefly. He brings up Samuel and Moses. They're known for having an intimate relationship with God. Samuel prayed for the people. I gave you a passage in 1 Samuel 7, I think. He prayed for the people. They were delivered from the Philistines. There's also another notable example about Moses. I gave you the passage. You can read it later. But in this story, in Numbers chapter 14, during Moses' life, he sends 12 spies into the land of Canaan to spy it out. We know the story. 10 men went to spy in Canaan, 10 were bad, 2 were good. Did anyone know that song? Okay, well, yes, good, the teenagers. Anyway, so they sent spies in to spy out the land of Canaan, and they brought back an evil report, made all the people said, we can't go in, there's giants in the land, we will be defeated. And so they all collectively agree not to take the promised land. And Joshua and Caleb are the only one who says that they should. Well, they all then get mad at Moses. They all say we should have died back in Egypt, and they start to make plans to set a captain against them over them to go back to Egypt. And God basically says they deserve to be destroyed because of this. And Moses prays for the people and says, well, you know, we can't destroy them because you have made certain promises to them that you would have to keep. And that would be a horrible testimony to the rest of this world. And God doesn't destroy them. Now, I don't think that God was necessarily making a plan and says, okay, Moses, I guess not. But at the same time, there's a sense in which Moses' prayers mattered. That was the point of the story. However, when you fast forward in the story, there is a very important point, though. Because God wasn't going to completely change the plan. He told them he wouldn't destroy them, but they wouldn't be allowed to go into the land of Canaan. They would have to stay for 40 years in the wilderness. When they hear that, the people, they say, just kidding, we'll go in now. That's what happens at the end of that chapter, chapter 14. And God says, no, I am not with you. I've already made the decision of how this is going to go. And they don't win that battle. And so actually, what we think God, and here's Moses, with that passage, doesn't communicate to us anything different. God wouldn't destroy the nation of Israel in Jeremiah's day either. And he would bring them back, and he would bless them. But for that generation that had chosen to reject God, they had chosen death, they would receive death. And we have to be careful as we live in a nation that's falling apart. We have to be careful to assume that we can just tell God not to respond to it because it's inconvenient, right? Because we look at the issues around us and we look at the problems that we have to deal with. And so we ask for the nation to get better, for prices to go down, and for there to be less crime. But the fact is, some of these things follow necessarily from the bad decisions of the world around us. And no matter how righteous we are, we cannot just say, well, God, make it not that way. Because sometimes God has already planned the best thing for our nation is for us to see judgment so that we turn. Whether it's Jeremiah or Moses or Samuel, God had made his decision. Righteous intercession does not manipulate God's plan. That's not what prayer is. Number two, righteous influence never makes anyone else's decisions for them. Oh, this is hard. Now remember, I told you at the beginning that this is not an exhaustive list of all the things that are true for a righteous person living in a doomed world. But right after he tells him that he wouldn't, whether it's Moses or Samuel or him who prayed for the people, captivity was coming. That was what was next. That's where we were now. And Jeremiah can't pray to undo that plan. That's what the plan is. But then he reminds the people about something. Verse number two. We'll read down to verse number five. And it shall come to pass, if they say unto thee, whither shall we go forth? What shall we do? Where will we go? He says, then shalt thou tell them, thus saith the Lord, such as are for death, to death. Such as are for the sword, to the sword. Such as are for the famine, to the famine. And such as are for the captivity, to the captivity. What does he mean by that? Where will we go? You will go to whatever it was that you have been for. Now, people don't choose death, sword, famine, and captivity. Not on purpose. But according to the covenant that they had made, you do choose death, famine, sword, and captivity. Because he says, if you choose to live this way, then you're choosing the outcome. He sets before us life and death. Nobody chooses to have death or chooses to have cursing, but they choose the things that lead there necessarily. So when the people will say to you, Jeremiah, where will we go? He says, you will go to what you have chosen to go to. And some of you have chosen captivity, whether you like it or not. That's the choice that you have made. Let's look for the rest of this chapter. Verse 3. I will appoint over them four kinds, saith the Lord, the sword to slay, the dogs to tear, and the fowls of the heaven, and the beasts of the earth to devour and destroy. And I will cause them to be removed into all the kingdoms of the earth because of Manasseh, the son of Hezekiah, king of Judah, for that which he did in Jerusalem. I won't go into it, but a couple kings ago lived in such debauchery for so long. It really brought the nation down, and they're still reaping the consequences. Verse 5. For who shall have pity upon thee, O Jerusalem? Or who shall bemoan thee? Or who shall go aside to ask how thou doest? So he says, if you've decided to go that way, then that way is where you will go. Remember, God said to them in the covenant, you will set before them life and death. And many of them had chosen death by accident. They had chosen famine. And they were getting famine in the drought. So it will come. I think it's interesting. He starts that question with, whither shall we go? When they come to you and say, where will we go? And it reminded me of the passage in John chapter 6. Remember that? Jesus is preaching a message, and it's a hard message. It's harder to swallow than some of the other messages he had preached. He had multitudes following him, but he was starting to deplete his discipleship because some people didn't want to hear everything he had to say. And so it says at the end of John chapter 6, and many walked no more with him. Then Jesus turns to his disciples and says, will you also go away? And then Peter asks the question, where will we go? Because you have the words of life. But then he says to Jeremiah the same thing. When the people say, well, where will we go? He says, you will go to what you have chosen. That's what Jesus does to his own disciples. What will you choose? Will you choose me or will you choose not me? And then you will get what that brings. Where will we go? The fact is, we have to remember at the end of the day, it is our responsibility to give truth. It's our responsibility to stand for truth. It's our responsibility to be a good example of truth, by the way. But as frustrating as it is, you cannot make someone else's decisions. Jeremiah is preaching truth, and he says, well, where will they go? They will go to where they've chosen to go. And Jeremiah's righteousness could not undo the choices of the people he was surrounded with. Long, long time ago, a couple generations ago, C.S. Lewis wrote an allegory. And it's an allegory, so it's supposed to be a story, called The Great Divorce. The divorce that he's speaking of in this allegory is the divorce between heaven and hell, between God's presence and the shadowlands, he would call it. And in this allegory, it's a really short story. All these people from the shadowlands get on a train, and they all go to basically the outskirts of heaven. They don't go in heaven, they go outside of heaven. And in the rest of the allegory, what happens is that all these people from the shadowlands, they all have a conversation with somebody who has previously passed on, and he says, I'm making no claims theological about this, but he wants to make one important point. Somebody from heaven has a conversation with them that they knew before they died. And in each conversation, in every chapter, the person from the shadowlands is talking to the person they previously knew, and they're talking to them about something that's important to them. Somebody that hurt them, bitterness that they had, money being important to them, prestige being important to them. And in every conversation, the person from heaven basically communicates to them that in eternity, none of those things matter. He says, you don't need to be bitter about things because God makes all things right. And the person would be like, you mean he's just going to like act like it never happened and just wash it all away and not acknowledge my hurt? Or somebody will talk about money, and he says, there's not rich people up here. Your money is not valuable. But you mean all the things I worked for, I have no value here? And then the person wanted prestige. He was like, nobody's famous here. We're all equal here. And this, so I was like, I'm just like them. And one after one, the person who sees the world from eternity's eyes speaks to the person who sees the world from the land, from the eyes of the shadowlands. And one by one, they each get back on the train and go back to the shadowlands. Now, what's the point? He said, people don't choose hell over heaven. People aren't choosing misery over joy. They're just choosing everything that's not important to God. And they choose to reject him by default. He says in the passage, he says, I have the quote here. There is always something they insist on keeping, even at the price of misery. And in a lesser sense, this is true every day. People don't want misery. They just don't choose God. And so they don't choose life. It doesn't matter how righteous you are. You can never make the decisions for them. And every one of those conversations, they had the opportunity to, and he wasn't claiming that this is the way it works, but they had the opportunity to talk to somebody who had already been there and saw it from eternity's eyes, and yet they still could not see past their own nose. And he says, you can have a conversation with people that's reasonable, that's righteous, but if they don't choose me, you cannot force it on them. And because they choose the shadowlands, not because they choose misery, but because what's important in the shadowlands is important to them. And at least they're accepted. And that's what we're surrounded with, and that's the decision we all make every day as well. We don't choose misery. We just often don't choose God. And because God has given us, because we're made in the image of God, God has given us the dignity of the free choice of our will and the outcomes of it. So along with that, number three, righteous care cannot change the consequences for bad decisions. We talked about the decisions a moment ago, but he says the decisions always have the consequence. Sometimes we want to make decisions for people. That's so true. Sometimes you just want to say, let me just make your life decisions for you. I think that'll be better for you. Can't do that. But sometimes we want to change the outcome. We want the decisions to have been made, but the outcome to just not be bad. So this is what God says. Verse number 6. Thou hast forsaken me, saith the Lord. Thou art gone backward. Therefore will I stretch out my hand against thee and destroy thee. I'm weary with repenting. We already read that. I will fan them with a fan in the gates of the land. I will bereave them of children. I will destroy my people since they return not from their ways. Their widows are increased to me above the sand of the seas. Many, many women would lose their husbands in the wars and in the captivity. I have brought upon them against the mother of the young men a spoiler at noonday. I've caused him to fall upon it suddenly and terrors upon the city. Another nation will come and spoil your people. She that hath borne 7 languisheth. So if you bear a lot of children, you should be well taken care of. That's kind of the cultural picture. And she had borne 7 children, but she still languishes. She has given up the ghost. Her son is gone down while it's yet day. And she hath been ashamed and confounded. And the residue of them will I deliver to the sword before their enemies, saith the Lord. This point's almost the same as the last one. Many of us have accepted the fact, though, that we can't make decisions for the people around us. But at the same time, many of us are just praying for a different outcome nonetheless. And just like Jeremiah wanted last week for God to stop the drought, just because the drought was a result of their sin. There was no rain because they had chosen sin, and because they had chosen sin, they had chosen famine. They that were for famine would be led to famine. That's what he just said in this chapter. And so Jeremiah, he means well. I'm not being hard on Jeremiah for this point, but what Jeremiah is praying for is that in spite of the evil decisions the people were making, that God should just make the outcomes different anyway, just because. And so he says this is the consequence that comes. And we know this. We understand this. I work over there in the main hallway of the school building. That's where my office is, and my door's open most of the time unless I really, really need to finish something, and so I need to have it really quiet so I can type, but usually my office door is open. And so I'm nearby the school, and so I hear the school goings on. And we have more and more students. We have well over 80 students now, and of course you have all those parents as well. And parents want their kids to do well in school. They do. They want them to get good grades. They want them to pass their tests. But for some reason, the way that a lot of parents manifest that love for their children is that when their child doesn't do well and they don't pass their tests, they want to ask the teacher and the administration to just somehow make it that they did. We all know those parents. Somehow it's the teacher's fault that the child didn't pass the test. And they want them to have the test unfailed. By the way, I wrote the word unfailed in my notes, and you know what happened? Word put a red squiggly line under that, because to unfail something is not a word, because you cannot unfail something. If you fail it, you fail it. It is what it is. I mean, suppose they love their kids. That's why. They want them to do well. They want to have the great future. And that's good. But what they want is that in spite of the decisions that were made, they want the outcome to just be different. I know they didn't know half the answers on the test, but can we just make it that they did? It's like, well, no. They don't know all the answers on the test. I mean, imagine if your child gets in a car, you love them, you want them to be safe, and they get in a crash, flip their car, the car crashes. And when you arrive at the scene, you walk up to the police officer and you say, because you love your child so much, can we just make it that my child didn't crash the car? Can we uncrash the car? It's like, well, no, the car's crashed now. It is what it is. I also wrote the word uncrashed, and you know what word did? Put a red squiggly line. You cannot uncrash something either, just like you cannot unfail. And the fact is, God has mercy, and that is true, and he can restore the years that the locust has eaten, but sometimes we spend our life trying to say, let's live as we please, and for God to just bless us anyway. And God says, this is what you have chosen. Those that are famine, they'll have the famine. Those who have chosen the sword, they will have the sword. And as righteous as we are, and as much as we care about people, and about our children, about our family, the consequences come out of the decisions that are theirs. And that's a good thing, because that means we get to choose how much we enjoy of the blessings of God. It's our decision about how much we get to enjoy God's blessing and his presence in our life. But the consequence to that, that gift from God, is that some won't choose it, which means they won't enjoy it. And you have to have both in order for it to be meaningful. Number four, I got to move on. In light of all of that, a righteous man, like Jeremiah, can develop a woe is me mentality. Woe is me. It's hyphenated on purpose. Now, I didn't manipulate that into that verse because the very next words, verse 10, Jeremiah speaks and says, woe is me. So that's where it came from. Woe is me, my mother, that thou hast borne me a man of strife and a man of contention to the whole earth. Here, even a righteous man develops this attitude, his circumstances are so bad, I just feel bad for my mom that this is that she bore a child that has to live in such circumstances like this. The fact is, the outcomes are not just about the other people. And this righteous man knows this because he has to live in this country. He has to live amongst the people. He has to live amongst the destruction that is promising to come. When he's praying for the people of Israel and the nation, he's also kind of praying for himself. Because every less judgment that the nation gets, he doesn't have to endure. One less that comes on him, comes on them, doesn't come on him either. And so now he kind of turns to thinking about his own situation. Letter A, here's a couple things that we can think. If we are trying to do what's right and the world around us is going to pot, here's a couple things that we can think. Letter A, I don't deserve this because I am righteous. And Jeremiah felt this way. God's not judging me, God's judging the nation around me. And since I'm righteous, I shouldn't have to go through it. I shouldn't have to deal with it. Look what he says, verse 10. Woe is me, my mother, that thou hast borne me a man of strife and a man of contention to the whole earth. I have neither lent on usury, nor men have lent to me on usury, yet every one of them doth curse me. He says, I've never defrauded anybody. I never had a bad business deal, and yet they still curse me. But then he goes on a little later, verse 15. Hop down to verse 15. O Lord, thou knowest me. Remember me and visit me and revenge me and my persecutors. Take me not away in thy long suffering. Know that for thy sake I've suffered rebuke. Thy words were found and I did eat them. We talked about that several weeks ago, that's a picture of we took God's word and we consumed it. It became part of us. He cherished God's word. Next, and thy word was unto me the joy and rejoicing of my heart, for I am called by thy name, O Lord God of hosts. Verse 17, I sat not in the assembly of the mockers or rejoiced. I sat alone because of thy hand, for thou hast filled me with indignation. And so now it's almost like he's pointing at God saying, hey, I did everything right. I suffered because of you. When all the people were doing the wrong thing and they were mocking and they were scorning, I didn't sit with them. I sat alone by myself because of you. So I shouldn't have to deal with any of this. Look, God, I've done everything I'm supposed to do, and that's good. But just because God promises to bless us is not the same thing as saying that we get to dictate exactly how everything plays out. We learned that in the book of Ecclesiastes, didn't we? Where just because we're supposed to fear God and keep his commandments isn't the same thing as saying we get to decide how much money we have and where we live and what relationships stay. Things come and go under God's sovereignty. We just have to choose to do what's right. And Jeremiah felt like he was owed something from God at that point. When people complain about their situation, I often notice they do what Jeremiah does. They bring up two things in their life. They bring up how righteous they are, and they bring up the problems that they have. Why do they do that? Because they feel like if they have been as righteous as they think they are, they shouldn't have many problems as they have, as if God owes them less problems than they have. By the way, he might be giving you less problems than you could have, but we wouldn't know because we don't have them. If you have anything that's less than ideal in your eyes, we will complain about it. We might have a lot more that he isn't giving us because he's blessing you. Maybe he is blessing you and you're just focusing on the areas that you wish were different. And Jeremiah, the fact is, he would be blessed. When the whole nation would go into captivity, he wouldn't. He will stay home. When everyone else is destroyed, he won't be. God was blessing him, but he still saw, but I still have to go through a lot, and I've tried to do everything right, God. And so we say, I don't deserve it because I'm righteous. Letter B. God promised everything would be easy, and it isn't. Most commentators agree that what happens in this in-between section is that Jeremiah is actually more narrating what God is saying than it is God actually talking. Verse 11. Jeremiah is still in the middle of talking, and he says, the Lord said, verily, it shall be well with the remnant. Verily, I will cause the enemy to entreat thee well in the time of evil, in the time of affliction. God said, you take care of the righteous, and the enemy wouldn't come. But then he says this, verse 12, shall iron break the northern iron and the steel? Remember that the future, the captivity would come from the north. Are our weapons going to be able to withstand the weapons of the coming nation from the north? And the answer to that is no. We won't withstand it. We won't win that battle. So verse 13, thy substance and thy treasures will I give to the spoil without price, and that for all thy sins, even in all thy borders, and I will make thee to pass with thine enemies into a land which thou knowest not, for fire is kindled in my anger, which shall burn upon you. So he narrates what God is saying, but he starts it all with saying that God said it would be well. God said that he would not cause the enemy to entreat us in the time of evil, in the time of affliction. And then they are anyway. And he's saying, God promised it would all be easy. Verse 18, why is my pain, Jeremiah says, perpetual, and my wound incurable, which refuseth to be healed? Now watch this. Jeremiah's talking. Wilt thou be altogether unto me as a liar and as waters that fail? What are you saying, God? You're gonna tell me you're gonna bless me, and then you won't? Will you be a liar to me? Will you be a well that I will go to when I'm thirsty and then I find no water? You waters that fail. Now he's laying the blame on God as if he's not living up to his promises. And that's a dangerous conclusion to draw, even for a righteous man. God does promise to bless us. When we choose life, we choose blessing. But he doesn't lay out exactly how that blessing will take place and in what way. Because not everything will be perfect. And that is one thing he has not promised, by the way. Sometimes we will live in a country that is doomed around us, and we will be one of the only righteous people. Regardless of that, not everything is supposed to be perfect in any version of this fallen world, regardless of how blessed or not the nation is. And how many Christians do we all know that have turned their back on God when something tragic happened? They held God accountable to a debt that he owed them for either being a good person or for simply existing, and that it could not be possible that a good God would allow them to go through whatever that suffering is. And Jeremiah is doing the right thing, but now he's feeling like God owes him something, and that if God doesn't make good on the deal that they had made, that God would be a liar. And so what does God say back to Jeremiah? Number 5, the righteous will experience God's blessing in God's way as long as he remains righteous. I guess just is, as long as he is righteous. Righteous will experience God's blessing in God's way as long as he is righteous. God's very soft with Jeremiah at the end here, and basically says, Jeremiah, I will take care of you, but just don't start acting like the rest of the world around you. Verse number 19. Therefore, thus saith the Lord, if thou return, then I will bring thee again, and thou shalt stand before me. And if thou take forth the precious from the vial, thou shalt be as my mouth. Let them return unto thee, but return not thou unto them. He's actually talking to Jeremiah specifically, because then he says that he will be his mouth as well. He says several things to him. He says, I will take care of you, but return to me. His heart was obviously leaving God a little bit in these bad times. By calling him a liar and waters that fail, that's starting to be a sense of bitterness. And he says, Jeremiah, return to me. trust me again. Recognize that I'm in control and I do all things well. He says, take forth the precious from the vile and you'll be as my mouth. Stop talking like the world does. Stop allowing the vileness of the world to infiltrate the truth that you're trying to preach. You give truth, but don't allow it to be tainted by the way the world thinks, which is what he was definitely doing a moment ago. He says this, let them return to thee, but return not to them. Tell the world to follow your righteous ways, but don't start acting like they do. And then he finishes up, verse 20. And if you do act like the righteous man, you were acting like Jeremiah, I will take care of you. I will make thee unto this people a fenced brazen wall. They shall fight against thee, but they shall not prevail against thee. For I am with thee to save thee and to deliver thee, saith the Lord. And I will deliver thee out of the hand of the wicked, and I will redeem thee out of the hand of the terrible. God always does keep his promises. We just got to be careful not to lay promises into God's mouth that he hasn't made us. He would preserve Jeremiah. But Jeremiah needed to stop arguing with God about how he would do what he was going to do and submit to it. So, in conclusion, stop trying to make God's plan for him. I'm feeling like we have the license to tell God how to handle the situation. Prayer is a request. It's not a demand. And sometimes we don't know everything that's going on, which means sometimes God's going to do what he knows he's supposed to do regardless of our take on it. Stop feeling like we have to or can make anyone else's decisions for them, or that we have the right to choose the consequences for other people's decisions after those decisions have been made. Don't develop a woe is me mentality and accuse God of not being good enough to you based on what you may or may not deserve. And if you want God's blessing, then you just need to do right and just trust him with it. That's why he says in Ecclesiastes, fear God and keep his commandments, for this is the whole duty of man. And he'll bring every work into judgment. He'll take care of the rest. Jeremiah had a job. It was a hard job, but it was a simple job. Do us right and preach the truth. And he wasn't going to be responsible for how God was going to play with the nation around him. And the same is true for us. As the nation feels very outside of our control, doesn't it? It really never was in our control. And our responsibility is to do right and to preach truth and to trust him. And so as we live as righteous people, or we ought to be, in a doomed world, allow God to be God, and let us just be us.